Welcome to the very special podcast, Panopticon 4.0. Today, English version, because my very special guest speaks this language and I decided to follow. I hope you will follow too, because that conversation, at least for me, sounds like a very interesting, very timely, much needed one. I have a great pleasure to be in Kraków, in Poland, together with David Lyon, who is the man, for me at least, who invented surveillance studies, who directs the Surveillance Studies Center and is a professor of sociology at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada. And for us at Panopticon has always been the mentor, the figure who taught us how to think, how to frame our thinking around contemporary forms of surveillance. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Thank Good you for here. For being here with me and taking the time during your short stay in Krakow. I preparing for this conversation, obviously I looked back in time because our history starts at least a decade earlier, and your history in studying surveillance, in thinking about surveillance, starts in the 80s, which is the time when I was a child. So you framed this area before we even had an idea as activists, as lawyers, to start our work in Poland. That's why I'm so respectful for the work you've been doing. Your book, The Electronic Eye, The Rise of Surveillance Society, was published in 1994. Panopticon as organization was founded 15 years later. And still at that point, we chose Panopticon as the metaphor of surveillance that we imagined is happening around us. We followed this Foucaultian thinking about power that circulates between people and works exactly as in this metaphor of perfect prison, where we are surrounded by controllers who we do not perceive. We never know who is watching us. We never know who is controlling our behavior. And therefore, increasingly, we start controlling ourselves. We start adjusting to this expected norm, even if nobody tells us that this is the norm of our behavior. That was the metaphor we had in mind back 10 years ago when Panopticon was started. Today, I feel life has changed, and our metaphors also for how power operates had to follow. What would be today your metaphor for how the power circulates or affects us, thinking about surveillance?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll circle around it and then come to the question directly. Interesting that you should mention the Electronic Eye from 1994, because, you know, I have had to learn more things about surveillance has developed. And so I don't even use the same definition of surveillance as I did in 1994. In the book that came out last year called The Culture of Surveillance, I referred to a different kind of definition that included not only a kind of top-down understanding of surveillance, that is to say, how we are watched, but also included the participatory, the lateral surveillance in which we are all involved. So now I talk about surveillance as the operations and experiences of the collection, analysis, and use of personal data. So I've had to shift my thinking anyway because the world has moved on and we have to think of new metaphors. And the funny thing about that new book, I'll tell you about the new book. And this gets to the metaphor question immediately. Maybe not metaphor so much as icon.
Mm,
okay,
icon.
So 1994, really the big thing in many countries was surveillance cameras, okay, CCTV.
So the eye was a reflection of power.
And so the surveillance camera was the thing. In fact, I was interviewed a few years ago in Rio, in Brazil, and they took me up to the top of the hotel, and the journalist from O Globo wanted to film me in a way that, you know, to photograph me for the newspaper in a way that would really sum up what I was doing. And she asked the hotel if she could borrow some old surveillance camera that was lying around. And I thought, oh man, I can see where this is heading. And she found one, And so there's this surveillance camera. She took me up to the top of the hotel where she was going to do the photo with a view of Rio beyond. And she made me hold this camera at my own head, as if to say, okay, so this is the surveillance guy. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure about that. And then with this new book, Culture of Surveillance, it came out just last year. And it's all about surveillance in the smartphone era. Okay.
The device that we willingly take with us. Nobody directs this at our heads. Nobody hides this from us and pretends they're not there, but it's something that we chose to possess.
That's right.
We are even extremely stressed out, I believe, when we lose one.
Yep. So I call this thing the PTD, the personal tracking device. Okay, and it's the personal tracking device that we carry with it. But
that will be the fair name for it.
When they advertise it, of course, they call it smartphone. So I wrote the book and sent it to the publisher, and the publisher sent the designer the idea, the concept of the book, and they came back with a cover that has two surveillance cameras on it, because the icon is still the camera. And we don't have a sense of contemporary surveillance, which, of course, includes camera surveillance, CCTV, smart CCTV especially.
Smarter and smarter, but recognizing faces.
But it doesn't come to that notion of surveillance by data. We're watched by data, not so much or not as significantly as... It's not the camera that is the significant thing anymore. It's the data, and the data especially that flows through the smartphone. So you ask about metaphors, you ask about, and I answer about icons. It's in the history of technology, we very often name something that relates it to an earlier era rather than to where the technology is developing. So we call the... smartphone, we call it a phone. The phone is just one very small aspect of what...
Some even switch off this function because they no longer use it.
Exactly. And so, you know, in the early 20th century, when the automobile is invented, what do people call it? Not automobile, not car. They talk about it as horseless carriage. So they still use an old name that refers to an old technology without thinking about the ways in which... the car, even from its earliest days, started to require certain kinds of things in order to exist. And now in the 20th century, you see that cities are built for cars. In a similar way, our whole lives are now structured by the world of smartphone digital activity, but we still call it phone.
And would you imagine that at some point we realize that this is the function of surveillance is key function of this device, so we will rename it?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I think the concept that I think is important here is that of mental distance. We have a mental distance between us and the reality of the technology. We don't recognize it as... This should be the icon. They should have put a smartphone on the cover of my book, but they put a surveillance camera on. We have a mental distance, and in order to really understand the world that we live in, we need to bridge that mental gap, that mental distance. And I think that's the key. And that's why we have to think about metaphors, explanations, definitions, etc., that are for today and not from yesterday.
All the more that the phenomenon that we are discussing here are so abstract, so non-tangible, invisible, without any metaphor, anything that person can imagine, like a prison. The concept of perfect prison, the concept of panopticon was useful, even though it does not really show how the power operates today, because it helped people conceptualize that they are trapped, that they observed, that they are controlled. Now we probably could talk about myriads of small little brothers observing us and us being in double role, observed and observing or surveillance and surveilling. I wanted to move in this conversation towards transformation of our behavior, which is a big thing in our human relation with technology. It's not only surveilling us, so it's not only collecting data that can and will be used against us to modify our behavior, but even the very effect of us using it and mediating our behavior through it changes the way we interact. When I've read another important book that you co-authored with Zygmunt Bauman, Liquid Surveillance, I was so relieved to read in your book counter-narrative around Facebook, questioning exactly the mainstream narrative of Facebook being a community place, mm-hmm. and making a very strong point that this is just a marketplace. Mm-hmm. This is just a place where we keep on trading in our privacy, in our attention, keep on exchanging certain services. But that's another form of market-driven oppression rather than any sort of community.
Yeah.
But then at least on Facebook we interact. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that people moving from Facebook to use various apps that help them move around the city, do shopping, buy tickets, do whatever they need to do on a day-to-day basis, they actually avoid human interaction more and more. And they interact only with technology, only with the application providing the service. How does this make us a different human being or a different society?
It's a frightening thing in some ways, but I, you know, we live right on the edge of a park, and so from our windows in our home, we can see people walking through the park all the time, and so often these days we see people, including fathers and mothers with little children, and they're walking through the park. And they're not in touch with their kids at all. The kids are kind of beside them, but they are absorbed in what's going on in the screen. That
quite often taking pictures of these kids and possessing them, maybe. So in a way, interested in behavior of the child, but not related to it.
But the human communication, the contact, the direct contact that could be there right where they are is just missing. So yeah, it does make a huge difference to the way that we communicate with each other. It doesn't mean, I think, that Facebook and platforms that make claims about Zuckerberg's claims about connecting with those whom we love. It doesn't mean that those claims are simply untrue
or cynical.
Because actually, you can use many of the platforms in ways that are maybe not intended by the makers of the platforms, but in ways that actually do enhance situations that help to at least cope with a world that has become so mobile and so difficult to keep in touch with people because we no longer have that proximity of neighborhoods and so on. So it can compensate at least for some of the ways in which
we can have with the close ones, the loved ones in physical space, then it becomes
it starts to destroy the relationships. You see a whole family in a restaurant sitting around a table, and I've seen this, not one of them is looking at the other or communicating with the other. All five of them are sitting.
Are we able
already?
Are you sociologists able to research this phenomenon, or is it still too early? Are we so much in the process of change that it's too early to say how it will affect our relationships, or do we already have some kind of observations that could be statistically viable?
I think there's some really interesting work going on exactly this, and including research at a very, local community level, at a familial level. I have colleagues who work a lot on how young people, high school age young people, are responding to the new technologies and especially to the surveillant dimensions of them. We had an event. We sometimes have public outreach from our research, and we had one a few months ago called Teens Talk Tech, and we had some teenagers who had been part of a research project come into the meeting place where we'd invited teachers and parents and teens to come and join in this discussion. And they talked about a media fast that they had had. So they'd taken a whole week with no social media at all. And it turned out that they...
Something that the parents would find difficult, I guess.
Exactly. what actually happened was they said we couldn't take a full and complete fast at all.
Because of the
adults in our lives required us to use social media, like for sporting, you know, coaching for sports or music lessons or whatever.
Uh-huh. They all organizing their life through social media.
To use the social media. So, you know, that was one thing. But they said apart from that, they took as much of a media fast as they possibly could. And the revelatory aspects of it for realizing what is possible when you are not constantly on your screen was amazing to them. And they spoke this is like 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, mm-hmm. talking about what they discovered.
By disconnecting.
About face-to-face relationships and about friendships. And this was just in 1 week of media fasting. But they all made decisions, you know, this group that came to talk. They all made decisions about how they were going to be far more careful following this media fast to ensure that they retained some of the things that they had discovered, face-to-face relationships, conversations, friendships, all that sort of thing, and that they were going to do this. And the interesting thing was, one of the interesting things, as the people were leaving at the end and kind of walking past me, because I was one of the organizers, they told me, while those kids were still talking, I started deleting apps on my phone. And so the adults were learning some important lessons from mm-hmm. the kids. So, yeah, there is research going on. And some of that research is very practical in the sense that it can be done in ways that really help people to rethink what they are doing with the new media and not simply assuming that what they're told in the advertising about devices that connect us to our loved ones.
We should definitely try to repeat
some skepticism.
This experiment in Poland. Right now at Panopticon, we use a product developed by our friends from Tactical Technology Collective, a global organization, which
good.
Is a data detox kit. Again, 10 steps or maybe 7 steps, I'm not sure, for adults mainly to not disconnect fully, but at least take back some control. Now I see that teenagers should be the avant-garde, that we should go to them first before asking their parents. But let me bring an extremely different example of experiment which is taking place as we live here in China. I'm thinking about social credit system, the we would say perfect surveillance system designed, capable, fully control interaction of human beings online and offline, because mm-hmm. in China, the level of street surveillance through these old surveillance cameras that we brought at the beginning of the conversation is massive. Mm-hmm. People can be surveilled both online and offline. This is happening. And when we read about this system, about the premises of the system, we immediately think, wow, this is the dystopia. This is the full surveillance scheme taking place. When we talk to, as I spoke in this podcast a couple of weeks ago, with people from China or understanding Chinese society, they bring different realization, different narrative. They actually say something like, we need trust. We need to build society based on trust in a greater extent, because we live in a damaged society where interaction is dangerous, where people don't know how to talk to one another. They don't know how to interact. For example, in market related situations, when you want to borrow money or buy something or get employed, that trust is missing, and that form of what we call surveillance, and for them it might be actually some kind of tool to map human being, to predict human being, might turn out to be helpful mm-hmm. in building this trust, in yep. enabling interactions.
Yep.
When I realized how different that narrative is in China, it really made me reflect on functions of surveillance, or mm-hmm. what we call surveillance, and what effectively is observation, collection of data about a human. Can you imagine a context in which by producing data, by being observed, we actually become somehow more connected or capable of doing together things that we wouldn't do otherwise?
Mm-hmm.
Like they say in China, that they are able to interact better, especially in the market context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Chinese have a clear idea of what it is that they want to produce, you know, what their purpose is in all this. Whereas a lot of the platform companies, for example, that we experience, it's very hard to understand what the corporation really wants. We know what they say and we know what they do, but those two don't.
We expect it's about money, but we don't know what comes with this money. What's really the
but
plan?
The Chinese do have this much clearer idea of what it is that they want to do, and also the business of trust has to do in for the Chinese people has to do in part with the ways that, unlike in the West, from the 1960s, the credit card became a tremendously important feature of lives in the West. So we learned, as it were, in the West to have a system of trust using credit cards that didn't previously exist. And so we learned to rely on relationships, transactions, and so on. It's a technological kind of trust, but it was still it is a form of trust. When you trust an institution or a technology, it is a form of trust. As dependence, perhaps, or dependability of the system, or the performance of the system, we could discuss that. But the Chinese do have a clear idea of what they want to do with this, and that's why you get these very contrasting views. The Western media portrays it as, you know, very dystopian indeed. The Chinese think
oppressive.
Of it and oppressive and repressive. And the Chinese have this different interpretation of it.
Because they say we want to build a better society for the purposes that we believe, political and economical. We want economic growth together with, political control, certainly. It's not a liberal society. Nobody ever claimed that it should be one. But, you know, on the other hand, when I reflect on the Chinese way, it immediately brings me back to our scoring systems, our systems that validate our value in the society. We started mentioning Facebook, and I think both of us strongly agree that it is a market space than anything else.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Within this market space, again, we are rated. Our value depends on likes, depends on social rating. How far these two systems really are, function might be different, but the essence of correction, of modification of human behavior, isn't it very similar?
Although the consumer aspect of each is very similar as well. So what we're looking at in China today is a form of authoritarian capitalism. It's still capitalism. It's still highly competitive. It has huge corporations.
It delivers economic benefits to people. The trickle-down effect happens there.
Involved. Yeah, yeah. But it's very large corporations and very large consumer-oriented corporations are involved in the social credit system. So Alibaba and ZTE and those massive corporations are involved. So if you look at the lives of people in a ultra-modern city like Shanghai, for example, then you'll see that there's massive consumerism, and it looks awfully like some Western capitals if you are in Shanghai, and the same kind of consumer outlook, but also the same kind of willingness to go along with the rating and ranking system.
The same smartphones.
Huh?
The same smartphones in their pockets.
Yeah, that's right. And so I heard of one study that showed how the Chinese people who are already on board with social credit are actually thrilled with it, because it's another way of indicating their forward-looking, socially mobile, socially upward mobile activities. And so already, despite the fact that the system is not yet fully complete until next year, until 2020 officially, they're actually joining the system as competing, just like in the West. You see people, you know, looking for the upgrades here and trying to improve their...
And they're joining Facebook.
Lifetime value to the corporation and all that sort of thing. So, you know, we see some very similar characteristics between the two. But Shanghai is one place. And Shanghai encourages a particular kind of consumerist outlook on the world and so on. But as soon as you start looking at some minorities within China, so for example, the Christian churches, which are prevalent in many cities and rural areas in China, they find that the things that are encouraged by the social credit system are not necessarily things that they want entirely to encourage. They would say that they want to be good Chinese citizens, but they don't want the notion of Chinese citizen totally to define their life. That's one group. The other would be the Muslim minorities, especially in northern China, in the Xinjiang area, where the Uyghur people are not only under huge surveillance, both smart CCTV, facial recognition, all that sort of thing, but actually being re-educated. I mean, they're put in these centers for re-education, and their life chances are very tightly constrained indeed. These are what the Chinese authorities call the two-faced people. They appear to be Chinese citizens, but really their face is a different one. And, of course, it's a very complex situation. But the way that they are treated is highly repressive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the same system is creating that sort of thing. So if we can kind of see a Google, Facebook kind of mentality in the rating and ranking system in a big city like Shanghai, we have to remember that it has its other aspects in the way that minorities are treated, in the ways in which anyone who wants to be a dissident from the Chinese authorities has to go very carefully, has to either go underground or, you know, in some cases of very courageous dissidents, they will come out in public and they spend time in prison for it. So the same kind of system is operating in many different ways. I mean, there's also the Confucius, what do we call them? Confucius Institutes that are set up, for example, in universities and colleges alongside the general education, which again is geared to the same idea of trying to produce this new Chinese citizen. It's like the datafied version of Mao Zedong's earlier attempts to create the new Chinese person, the new ideal human being. It looks to me suspiciously like what Mao was doing in the 20th century.
What you describe clearly shows that in China, it is the vision of a better human, the vision of the society is quite centralized, and it comes from those in power who are able to either convince probably even the majority of Chinese people who follow this vision, and the rest, the minorities, are forced to follow. But let me loop this conversation back to the West, where at least we believe that we live in liberal democracies, so systems where the vision of society should go bottom up. We should be the agents of change. We should be able to say to our elected representatives, this is the vision of the society we follow. And then thinking again about the smartphone driven self-surveillance applications like Facebook, networks in which we willingly participate and promote ourselves to take part in the market game, how confident you are that we are consciously choosing a certain better version of society for ourselves, and to what extent this is some kind of vision again imposed on us, but maybe not by the state, but rather by commercial entities who sell us this desire to self-improve, to become more effective, faster, better. I'm wondering, looking at the West, is it us? Is it us who really want to excel, who want to speed, who want to compete, or somebody sold us this narrative ages ago or years ago, and we kind of forgot that we bought in? We believe we were free to choose, but again, we were like Chinese, just following some kind of imposed vision.
You can make the connections directly. The Chinese corporations are very keen, as you know, to sell all kinds of things to the rest of the world. The Chinese systems are not for China alone. Look at the power of Huawei in Poland.
Yeah. As long as politicians do not close the door for them, they will be here. They will be on the market.
Exactly. And sometimes they are invited very warmly. There was a piece recently about the city of Darwin in northern Australia. and they are adopting, within that liberal democracy, a kind of smart city approach to, policing, but it has very broad ramifications, that is directly bought from China. And, of course, the Chinese are also selling in global south countries, African countries, for example, the kinds of technologies that they're using. So
Before Chinese companies started selling us their smartphones, I think we already bought into the narrative promoted by U.S.-based corporations who've been around for two decades. Mm-hmm. And if I were to look for sources of this constant drive to improve, to go faster, to be more efficient, it is rooted in Anglo-Saxon version of neoliberal capitalism. This whole concept of managing yourself, managing time, managing yourself in time, managing your relationships. And here, my biggest worry, in fact, is not that we will be tricked by somebody, that we will be oppressed by a super powerful state with our version of the social credit score or even a one single huge corporation. My bigger worry that I already see actually happening in reality is that we will do it ourselves, mm-hmm. that we will use every tool coming up. Is it a smartphone or is it a intelligent device controlling my brain potentially, because we are moving that way. We are moving towards smaller and lighter and cheaper devices that are able to read what happens inside of our brain, that we will desire them as mm-hmm. consumer products, mm-hmm. as a lifestyle, as a way of improving ourselves, because somebody will tell us, hey, by installing this device on your head, you can think clearer, you can sleep less, you can go on a better diet, you can maybe run faster, that we will endlessly buy into this logic. This is something I read also between the lines of very, very popular books by Yuval Harari, who is on one hand criticizing, I feel so, a human being for being so imperfect, such a failed structure, biological structure that is so imperfect, but at the same time selling us this notion that by using technology that you control, that fiction that you can, or dream that we can control it at some point, which I never believe in, will help us improve. Yeah. What do you think? Where does it take us?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right about the ways in which neuroscience, for example, is becoming tremendously important. Artificial intelligence based especially on neuroscience, which is why Facebook has its own neuroscience lab right in Manhattan.
And Google probably has 10 of them.
Probably. You know, that idea is tremendously important, and Shoshana Zuboff writes about it in The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. I wish that she had written it in a bit more of an integrated way, showing how other people were also writing about the same sort of thing. But she does make the points very clearly, I think, about the ways in which Google operates and the increasing reliance on brain science, brain scanning, eye tracking, all those kinds of things to convince us that we need this new device, to convince us that we need to go in this consumer direction. But I think that it does raise fundamental questions, and so does the Harari work. I haven't read a lot of the Harari material.
It reads quite fast, so you could do it on the plane.
I know the basic premises there, and that kind of they bother me somewhat too. I mean, he talks about the whole edifice of what he calls humanism being brought down by a
neuroscience as well.
New religious scientific notion of dataism. And he sees that
as, also questioning our integrity, questioning yeah. that there is really not such thing as human in its essence, as a self. Maybe, okay, mm-hmm. maybe we exist as humans, we exist as biological structures, but what really makes us unique, what really makes mm-hmm. me consciously choose the way I want mm-hmm. to live, if it's all about biological and chemical processes in my brain that I can modify or somebody can modify for my benefit, because that's, I think, at the core of the argument. Can we imagine a better human being becoming as a result of this modification? Mm-hmm. Or do we say no, in essence, to being modified, because that no longer means being human?
Yeah,
human has to be imperfect.
But it comes down to exactly the sort of argument that you are alluding to. You're talking about things that have to do with philosophical and religious, you know, spiritual beliefs. How can we operate in a way that is human without confronting those kinds of things? As I understand it, Harari really is a biological determinist. He thinks that we are determined by that kind of biological
Correct.
Progression, and that seems to me to be entirely mistaken. I do agree with him when he talks about the religion of dataism. And I don't agree with what he says about it,
yeah.
but I think he's right. That
we live in the time of this religion,
towards a period when we rely on data in a religious kind of way. We believe that somehow there's such a thing as raw data, which I don't believe for a start.
And there will be, once the general AI taking the best choices or suggesting as the best possible decisions on the basis of this raw data. So there will be also a source of decisions, like another instance,
yep.
like a new God that we can refer to when we don't know what to do,
yep.
when you don't know whether you want to continue supporting a life of a person that has been in coma for years. Who do you ask? You ask AI, because mm-hmm. she, the new agent, will know better than yeah. another human being. So we
exactly.
definitely
or
go this way.
In other cases of legal choices, too. You know, should this person be released on bail? Should
yes.
this person continue in prison? Should this person, you know, there are many legal cases that they now have, you know, they have an app for it, as it were, and it has to do with artificial intelligence, machine learning, and so on, as if somehow that could have an ultimate answer to these questions. And again, I think we're in a very different realm. When somebody like Jose Van Dyck uses the word dataism, she's using it to say that, yeah, we are in a dangerous situation where this new belief that somehow data, raw data, analyzed by the right algorithm, can somehow produce a better world. It's, to my mind, completely the other way round. If we're thinking in terms of human beings, you know, I think we're in the world of people who are certainly decision-making characters, but more importantly, we're spiritual beings, if you like. I mean, the theologians talk about the imago Dei, the image of God, and that seems to me to be much more productive in thinking of, okay, how does technology work here? What's the role of data here? If that kind of image of God idea has any traction to it at all, then it means that our doing technology, our technological activities, is something that is done for the common good. It is done for the other. It is done in a way that is not entirely centered on my consumer decisions. And really, I think we're back to that consumer question as well, because the whole edifice of the platform companies is built around the consumerism, or built upon the consumerism.
Yeah. A great fallacy that
developed
we should question
in the late 20th century and has now flowered in the platform. Well, flowered is a poor word for it. It's an insult to flowers to describe
True.
It as flowering.
It's degraded,
but,
too.
Yeah. But so, we should be saying, all our making, our doing, our technology production and so on should be for the flourishing of humans and for the planet. It's for the other. It's not just for what I want, I need, or I've been told that I need. It seems to me that we're asking fundamental questions. And I'm glad that we are, because it seems to me the question of how we decide where we want to go with this.
With this whole science.
Is the critical question.
That could support human beings.
How is it telling us how we should work through some clever algorithm? I think we need to stand back, because, of course, then they say, oh, well, there's always the question of the human in the loop, and how far should the human in the loop exist when it comes to medical decisions, legal decisions, all manner of decisions. Well,
yeah, quite often it's just a fallacy. Human in the loop resigns, gives up on with critical mind when he or she sees suggestions by the powerful AI. But there is one more fallacy or danger or a hidden premise in this whole dataism and believe that we have all the answers in data, which is pretending that there is no political agent, that there is no agency on the side of companies who design these algorithms, who collect this data, who choose which data to collect, who design systems that produce certain results. So believing in data as if it was something neutral, a resource in which we are by which we are surrounded or which we produce, and it's like air or water or earth. No, it's not. It is a very special kind of resource that at the point of being generated already might contain bias or might be tinted with certain political concept or economic concept or commercial concept. Mm-hmm. These premises are always built in the system. Therefore, we always, in this conversation about AI and data at Panopticon, we make sure that we always bring back the agent, the company in the center, the Google, the Facebook, Amazon, anybody who is in the game, who has its own logic of power and its own vested interest. And let's maybe finish this conversation. We could take for hours, I'm sure of that. But
it would be a lot of fun to do it.
We have to stop it soon. But I really want to hear your view on these agents, on these powerful agents. What are the concepts in Canada or in your intellectual circles, how to deal with them? Because in Europe, we are obviously quite keen on regulating them. We try to do it better and better. The European Commission will come up next year with another legal act on these platforms trying to curb their power. Is this a way to go, or you see this differently?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a whole lot of questions there. You started by talking about the myth of data neutrality. I think that's a critical one. But alongside that is the idea of technological inevitability. The doctrine of technological inevitability, this thing has got to happen. You hear it in the Apple ads for their upgrades. And in the Apple case, it's very obvious that it's inevitable that there will be, after the iPhone 11, there will be an iPhone 12.
Yeah,
we know.
And we have to keep up. And otherwise, your Apple will stop working.
Apple has probably already planned the day when they launch iPhone 12. I mean, they love to exude a sense of technological inevitability. This is the next thing that technology brings to us. But that, I think, is the most dangerous doctrine of all, the idea of technological inevitability, because it suggests, as you say, that there are no agents involved in the production of the technology, the advertising of the technology, the selling the technology, and yet it is patently obvious just how much goes into the planning and the construction of the situations.
You know, which like we feel trapped. And
like
we feel,
the launches
we feel
of new
we have
Apple
to play
upgrades.
The game.
That's right. And so that notion of technological inevitability, that somehow it's going to happen and we have to go with it. And legal scholars sometimes fall into the same trap of saying, oh, well,
they just come up with another regulation and they always say, oh, it's too late.
Yeah.
It's late for what?
We can't keep up with it. It's,
exactly.
It's moving
Keeping
too fast.
Up with technology.
It is moving too fast. Actually, people are making decisions
exactly,
that are
to move it.
Making it move along. And so I think we have to reclaim agency in some very, very strong ways.
Can we do it with
ways.
Use of law, in your opinion?
I think we can. Okay. These issues that we're talking about, I mean, Cassia, we're talking about massive issues of humanity on planet Earth in a digital era that is increasingly subject to this datafication that is everywhere, and it has huge surveillance aspects to it. So we're talking about very big things, but I'm sure it's right to think about them in these very large ways. What is wrong is to imagine that somehow there is a way of treating these situations, you know, that the
just
big
a list of choices you have to make,
or a silver, bullet that will actually be the thing that solves our problems. It's not like that at all. Because it is so multifaceted, I believe that however we approach it has to also to be multifaceted.
I like to compare it to ecological crisis. That's it's just
right.
another type of crisis yep. happening in another environment that we live in.
But it's exactly that. You know, that analogy that is so helpful. We have to make our own decisions when we go to the store to buy food, when we cook it, how we treat packaging, all those kinds of things. They're crucially important decisions, actually, equally for the future of humanity. So,
but also there are these huge political decisions that enable operation, be that in production of goods or plastic, or be that in production of data, where I want powerful agents to come to the game and say no to certain practices, to certain practices of dominant platforms who, as in your example with Apple, sell us a narrative that is not... It doesn't have to be there.
Yeah.
We can question it.
Yeah.
Same way we can question the way Facebook functions as closed platform and demand openness from it, or demand from Google that it shares data it collected on humans, on millions of humans, with us for the benefit of society. We can do it. Politically, we can.
I mean, we also have, as we were saying right at the beginning of our conversation, we also have to deal with the actual situation that we have today. Platforms are by definition monopolizing. That is part of their lifeblood.
They use network effect by definition.
To
That's
become
how they run.
Monopolistic. That is their intention. That's the way that they're built. And so they can't simply be treated in the same way as antitrust movement in the United States in the 20th century was trying to treat the big railway companies and so on and so forth. These are different kinds of corporations, but it doesn't mean that we can't do anything. I do think there's a place for regulation. I do think there's a place for local decisions, even on a, you know, citywide basis. And after all, for most people, it's their own city, their own environment that they will care about most. And that's not inappropriate. But I think we have to think at multiple levels simultaneously, but at every level.
So from the data detox that I take to the very high political, geopolitical even level where we expect decision makers to take the right position towards these platforms and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. Everything in between, and you know how parents and grandparents talk with their children and grandchildren about
where
being
they
online
upload
and
pictures.
The screen. And and where they upload pictures. I think at every level there has to be much more awareness. And that's why we need to actually get our sense. We need to reduce that mental distance that we were starting with at the beginning. Let's not think that it's just surveillance cameras. Let's think smartphone. That should be the icon for surveillance in the 21st century. So if we face the realities as they really are, but also come to it with a strong sense of the humanity that we would like to see develop and where the, you know, care for the other and the attempt to work against one of the key features of all surveillance systems, which is to divide the population into groups and to treat certain groups in ways that are vastly preferable to those that are marginalized and made more vulnerable. Those are the key things that apply in China, as they do in Poland, as they do in Canada. And the rating and ranking systems are very much geared towards certain groups who comply with the intentions of the system. And that, it seems to me, is one of the biggest challenges that we have to confront, whether we're talking about the world of consumer capitalism in the West or authoritarian capitalism in China. In every case, I think we have to ask those questions and confront them at every single level possible.
Well, thank you for not giving the simple answers, but showing the full picture or the full scale of the challenge that we are facing as humans, regardless of where we live. Is it Canada, China, or Poland? I really enjoyed taking this deep dive in the very complex matrix of surveillance and learning how to think about it, how to conceptualize it, but also your practical advice kind of cold shower for all of us that the time to act is now, and you cannot escape this action by saying, oh, somebody else will deal with it for me, or I will just buy a better smartphone, because that's not going to solve our problems. Thank you, David. I really enjoyed being with you today, and I hope it's not the last conversation we have on this topic, because it will continue to be important, I'm afraid.
Likewise. Thanks for the opportunity. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. I was here with David Lyon, and my name is Katarzyna Szymilewicz. You are listening to a special edition of my podcast, Panopticon 4.0. Thank you for being here.